Arthur Machen once wrote that strange things are lost and forgotten in obscure corners of the newspaper. This podcast will aim to prove that that statement is true. Hello, and welcome to the second episode of Forgotten Darkness. I'm Andrew Gable. So on the last episode, things got a little bit grisly when we were discussing the murder, or I guess I should probably just say death, of David Shearer. To be honest, I think I agree with the conclusion that it might have been just a suicide with an unfortunately damaged body, and to be honest, that makes me feel a little bit better about the body's condition, to be honest. But anyway, in this episode, we'll switch gears a little bit and go with a story of the unexplained. Or I guess I might say folklore, as I don't really know how much real is in the story. There's some information in here about associated people and organizations that you might find irrelevant, but it's something I like to do when possible, is just try to get more information on witnesses, the people who wrote the things, other things associated with a story. Sometimes it helps put things in context. I think it, in a way, did in this story. As I alluded to in the last episode, I've always loved 50s monster movies. I remember Saturday afternoon spent not outside doing kid things, but watching whatever old horror movie happened to be on that weekend. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, Them, Tarantula, Godzilla. I dug all those movies, even though I'm not really under any misapprehension, that there were very many of them that were actually, like, good. But I loved all those stories of rampaging dinosaurs and giant bugs and super big octopi living in the ocean and stuff like that. In a lot of ways, the next story always struck me as like a 50s monster movie in a lot of regards. So I give you the story of The Beast of June Week. For probably as long as mankind has existed, the oceans have commanded a great respect and a great fear. The murky depths have held just as many gods and celestial spirits in the world's myths as it has monsters. From benevolent, if often temperamental, deities, which, in a way, that's very like the sea itself, like Poseidon or Oannes, who came from the ocean to teach civilization to the ancient Babylonians, to monsters like the Kraken or the Cetus. It seems that from early days mankind recognized the ocean's ability to grant life as well as to destroy it. June week is a week in, unsurprisingly, early June, although now, oddly, it's held at the end of May. When students graduate from West Point, the Annapolis Naval Academy, and other military institutions. In 1987, Annapolis Capital journalist John Mellon uncovered an account of one June week sometime after 1871. Not sure what the exact year of that may have been. It was penned by a Reverend James L. Smiley, pastor of St. Anne's Episcopal Church in Annapolis, sometime during the 1930s. Now, ironically, in the 80s, there was a woman named Nellie Walston who would see the Chesapeake Bay sea serpent, which is known as Chessie, from the grounds of that very church. Writing in the 1930s, Smiley states that for once in its history, June week at the U.S. Naval Academy suffered a counterattraction. In spite of the most brilliant military and social functions, it was outshone in popularity by an unexpected and unique visitor. Even the President of the United States, who had come over from Washington to deliver the diplomas, attracted less attention and interest. Reverend Smiley identified himself as a Christian socialist. In other words, he believed that the actions of Jesus in the Bible, namely his notable dislike and disregard for the rich, indicated that he either was a socialist or at the very least would be sympathetic to that philosophy. This is still a fairly common religious point of view today. He had also run for the Maryland Senate as a socialist candidate in the 1920s, though apparently unsuccessfully. He continues that the queer visitor had first been sighted off the Virginia Capes. He had then been seen by the war vessels as they came into the Chesapeake Bay en route to Annapolis Roads. He was described as a monstrous white shark of tropical haunts, apparently about 40 feet long. Popular conjecture had it that the shark, a ferocious man-eater, had gotten the wanderlust and had migrated north on a sightseeing tour. Appearing at intervals farther and further north, it wasn't long before he was seen just north of Kent Island, and then only 15 miles from Annapolis. Then the civil and naval authorities took decisive action. They warned all small craft to stay at home. Two state police boats were ordered out with instructions to shoot to kill. That these guardians of fishing failed to hit the monster was acclaimed with delight by the populace, for everybody wished to see him alive. Now, it's a bit interesting to me that he says it's a white shark, presumably he means a great white shark, but is apparently about 40 feet long, because that's considerably longer, bigger than any great white shark I've ever heard of. But more on that later. Later in the account, Reverend Smiley says that the local boating charter companies responded, as they would have in any good or bad B-movie, which is part of why I said this reminds me of a 50s science fiction movie, by promptly issuing fully packed tourist boats from Baltimore and Annapolis in search of the monster. Further, he notes a pretty barbaric method of baiting the giant shark to the surface. Whenever the monster was sighted, the boat would steam slowly toward the spot and throw a live dog overboard. Within a few seconds, there would be a streak of swift wave, a flash of brown fins and white belly, and then the poor dog would disappear in an immense mouth, ferocious with rows of glittering teeth. Dogs soon became a very scarce article in Annapolis. Their prices soared phenomenally. Some humane citizens protested against this cruel use of dogs for shark bait, but others contended that it was a very merciful way to dispose of homeless canines. Owners of dogs wisely kept their pets safe indoors, while boys and even men combed the streets and byways for this lucrative quarry. With the small boys, June week is always a harvest season for toting valises and suitcases, but this year many of them found that dog hunting at $5 apiece a better paying proposition. The Reverend's account had been found in a book which had belonged to the Maryland Anti-Vivisection Society. The Anti-Vivisection Societies of years gone by were sort of precursors of what would today be called PETA. It can be gleaned from perusing the editorials in old newspapers, especially from Baltimore, and from the Society's own newsletters and journals, that the Maryland Society in particular had some, they had some fringe ideas in defending animal rights. Some things that probably would be considered today, skeptical researchers would probably call them like woo ideas, because they were very bizarre. Like, the practice of dog collecting was one that the society decried, likely accounting for their interest in this story, because the cruelty of, you know, feeding dogs willy-nilly to a giant shark surely suffices by itself, to be fair. But as an indicator of the sorts of tactics that they used, they not only condemned the rounding up of mad dog, but they questioned the very existence of rabies itself, which is completely ludicrous, because it's like, I understand you want to protest picking up dogs basically just to kill them. I understand that. But to say I disagree with that and then go further and say, well, I don't even think rabies exists, that's just a little bit ludicrous. And they were not only opposed to the use of animals in the testing of vaccines and surgical techniques, but sort of consistently with the above, they also questioned the very fact of whether those vaccines and surgical techniques were actually useful at all. Most interesting was this idea they had of an animal soul. Now, on the surface, that's not really a particularly strange idea for animal, especially for an animal rights group. But what was strange was that the society accepted the word of a Dr. Anna Kingsford, who claimed to have visited the physiological laboratories in vision, or as some would express it, in her astral body, and who declared that every animal enclosed a human shape, the shape of a man. So it was believed, you had to read some other pieces of their literature and things, but it was believed that the animals not only possessed a soul, but that their soul was, like, literally human, and that they were, that animals themselves were actually just devolved human beings, not, you know, a completely different species or anything. Now, I'm not certain if Reverend Smiley was actually associated with the society at all, although a lot of other members of the clergy were, so to be honest, I wouldn't really be too surprised at that. Regardless, his account is pretty sketchy at best, if you ask me. He doesn't really provide any actual date except after 1871. And all we really need is the shark, like, rampaging through the streets of Annapolis or Baltimore, and it would sound like the script to an early version of Beast from 20,000 Fathoms or something like that. But did it actually have its origins in real events? John Mellon, who was the journalist who first wrote about this account, believed that it might have, and I kind of agree with him, actually. He uncovered articles in the Annapolis Advertiser from 1886 that detailed a number of sharks seen near the mouth of the Severn River, which goes directly north of Annapolis. And other articles from the Civil War era indicated that there was a severe overpopulation problems of stray dogs in post-war Annapolis. Many other articles and newspapers of the time seemed to contribute various elements to the story as well. The Richmond Times, on June 13, 1891, detailed how a sailor named John Howard from the ship Silver Queen fell overboard and was killed and eaten by a school of sharks around the Hampton Roads area at the around Norfolk. And shortly afterwards, there was a school of sharks that had been seen in that area and was presumably the ones that killed Mr. Howard. A few days afterwards, a 10-foot shark appeared in the Patapsco River near Baltimore. And then on August 18th, 1895, a Captain W.H. Burtis in Annapolis captured and killed a 9.5-foot shark at Greenbury Point, which is at the mouth of the Severn River, which I just mentioned earlier. At the end of that same month of August 1895, three sharks, two large and one quite small, were seen in Curtis Bay, which is just south of Baltimore. This instance, I thought, was particularly notable because the idea of using stray dogs as bait for the sharks was specifically mentioned, at least by some people. It was, you know, the people didn't really get names in the story, so it was kind of probably just a general rumor going around town that nobody ever actually intended on actually doing. But, I mean, that's significant because that exact tactic is mentioned in the Annapolis giant shark sighting. A number of large sharks were seen off Kent Island and in the Chester River in 1898. And, well, I could keep going on, but I'm just not even going to mention them all. There is, unsurprisingly, there's just a number of reports of sharks from the Annapolis and Baltimore vicinities in the following years. It's probably almost futile to try to catalog all the instances. When you start going through old papers from Northern Virginia and Maryland, there's literally hundreds of reports of sharks in the Chesapeake. So the notion of a shark making its way into the Chesapeake obviously is not anything unusual, as you would think, because, I mean, the Chesapeake is part of the ocean. It also turns out that James L. Smiley had encountered, I guess encountered is maybe the right word, he sort of encountered it, but another instance of weirdness, also during June week, weirdly enough. In 1921, he wrote a piece on a sort of a angelic visitation that he claimed to have had during a parade at the event. I'm just going to present the account here in full, because I think with visionary experiences like that, it can be difficult to, like, isolate, you know, particular elements of the story. You usually have to just take the whole story as it is. That was always one issue I had with, there was a supposed sighting of a flying dragon type thing in the Catoctin Mountains. And what I found, when you go back and actually look at the original article describing that, which was in the Frederick News, that whole thing was actually more of like a religious vision that somebody had while they were driving. And it all sorts of weird imagery came up, and the dragon was only a very small part of it. And I just felt, I mean, you can't isolate that dragon sighting as a sighting of a cryptid when you can't remove it from the entire experience.
To the editor of the Sun, sir, Peace Sunday following immediately upon June week at the United States Naval Academy. The public mind has two great subjects, forcibly presented in contrast, disarmament and preparedness. To clear away the fog that these subjects precipitate in some consciences, permit me to imagine a brief dialogue. Watching the brilliant dress parade on the magnificent campus with thousands of thrilled spectators, I am suddenly accosted by a stranger at my side. A splendid body of young men, he remarks. Yes, I reply, the very pick of our country. Did you ever seriously consider the goal of the all-military education? With some surprise, I answer, certainly. The goal is the defense of the United States. Defense against what? Pestilence, famine, earthquake? Suppressing a smile at such naivete, I explain, defense against any nation that may attack us. Oh, then these young men are being trained to maim or murder other youths, perhaps as noble and handsome as themselves. War does not consider such sentimental feelings. It aims to do all possible damage to the enemy. Suppose, he persisted, that the United States Congress should appropriate at once $500 million for the distressed peoples of the earth and send forth its navy laden with food, clothing, and other necessaries, the well-disciplined officers and men to be the distributors. His voice rang out now like a clarion. Such a revolution in national action would electrify the whole world. It would stamp the United States as the unassailable friend of all nations. The men of your navy would be recognized as wonderful missionaries of mercy, and the militarism would slink away from the earth in abject shame. The trumpet blast of this final sentence drowned all the band music and the shout of the officers. It shook the campus like an earthquake. I expected a panic, but none followed. The stranger vanished. The military maneuvers continued without interruption, and I realized that I alone had seen and heard the heavenly visitant. Baltimore Sun, June 7th, 1921.
I'm not sure if it's just a coincidence or not, but there was actually a submarine that was called the Shark that arrived at Annapolis, accompanied by two others, the Porpoise and the Plunger, on March 20th, 1907. As described in the Baltimore Sun for March 21st, the arrival of the submarine boats Porpoise, Plunger, and Shark at Annapolis today marked the establishment at the Naval Academy of the first fleet of that type of vessel in the Navy. The fleet is under the command of Lieutenant Charles P. Nelson, and the Porpoise is the flagship. They will be used at the Academy for the practical instruction of midshipmen. The Shark was a 63-foot vessel that was constructed in 1901 in Naval Yard in New Jersey. And it had formerly been moored in Newport, Rhode Island, and had been towed down to Maryland and then up to Annapolis. Another aspect of the tale of sharks in Maryland that I'd be remiss not to mention is the presence in Calvert County of giant sharks, although they be dead ones. Calvert Cliffs State Park, which is about 30 miles south of Annapolis, contains a rich deposit of fossilized sea life from the Miocene period, which was approximately 17 million years ago. These fossils contain representatives of virtually every type of sea animal you can think of, from insignificant shellfish to whales and shark's teeth. Now, many of the remains are still being revealed as the cliffs erode. Most of the shark's teeth are from species that we still have in the oceans today, but one notable species that's present is not, and that is the famous Carcharocles megalodon, which has been renamed from its former name Carcharodon. So, you'll usually hear it as Carcharodon megalodon. Technically, it has not actually been known as Carcharodon megalodon for a number of years now, because it was discovered that it wasn't quite as closely related to the modern great white shark as they had previously thought. There were a little bit more differences, so it was removed from the Carcharodon family, which is what the current great white shark is in, and given its own Carcharocles. But anyway, I digress. But the teeth of the megalodon are found relatively rarely, but the skeletal remains of a baleen whale, possibly an ancestor of the humpback whale, was also found in 2004 by an amateur fossil hunter named Jeff DiMeglio further south along the St. Mary's River outside Solomons. The teeth of several shark species were found intermingled with the bones of the whale. Now, significantly, one of the early sightings of the Chesapeake Bay sea monster, which I mentioned earlier, Chessie, was that of a small girl who saw a dragon near Calvert Cliffs. Now, I have been wondering if the monster in her account was actually maybe one of these fossils. Because if I was a little kid and I was walking along the beach and I found the skeleton of a whale or some other aquatic, old extinct aquatic reptile, I'd understand calling that a dragon. And especially doubly so if there were jagged, monstrous looking shark's teeth mixed in with those remains. So, what was the reality of the Beast of June Week? Was it an actual giant shark? Was it some sort of conglomerate tale cobbled together from bits and pieces of disparate tales? My money's on that, because there seems to be no confirmation of the account from any source other than Smiley's writings, which you'd think there would be. Somebody else would have mentioned something as notable as a 40-foot shark that ate dogs. But nobody else has. Of course, given his previous experience, you can't rule out that it was some sort of religious allegory or religious vision that the Reverend had had as well. Significantly, the other, at least the one religious vision that we know of, significantly June Week factors into that one as well. So, like, could this have been, I don't know, some kind of a sort of interpretation of some sort of sea monster from biblical lore, like the Leviathan or the Beast from the Sea in the Book of Revelation, or I don't know. But, so, you know, what do you think it is? I, as I said, I'm still betting on it's just bits and pieces from all these different stories just got smooshed together. But anyway, that's the end of this episode. A list of sources I've consulted for this episode can be found in the show description. If you have a question, a comment, or if you know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see me cover, leave a comment on the podcast page, post it to our Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, or send it to our email at ForgottenDarkness77, lowercase f, lowercase d, all one word, @gmail.com. And so, until the next episode, this is Andrew, signing off.